Welcome to Relationships 2.0. I'm Michelle Skeen. My special guest today is a special person to meet, and he's been on the show before, and I feel really honored because we're actually going to be discussing a manuscript of his that isn't published yet, but I'm sure it will be, and it's called The Beginner's Eye, and my special guest is Thomas Roberts. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, Michelle. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Doing fine. Sounds like you got some nice hot weather out there.
Well, where I'm up in San Francisco, so me and I were just talking about how I'm in the 60s where I am, but I think they're nearing the hundreds.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Anyway, and for the listeners, I want to let them know that the last time you were on was December 3rd, discussing your book, The Mindfulness Workbook, A Beginner's Guide to Overcoming Fear and Embracing Compassion, in case they want to go to my website or iTunes and listen to that podcast. I love that mindfulness workbook, and I really enjoyed your manuscript.
Thank you.
Beginner's Eye.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It's close to being finished and should be out probably in a couple months.
Oh, that's awesome. Oh, yeah. So it is in the, it's getting printed up and released soon.
Well, it just went through the editing phase and now it's going through layout and we're looking probably end of August, beginning September.
Oh, that's terrific. And your website is thomasrobertsllc.com, so I'm sure you'll have announcements on there as well. And people will be able to find it on Amazon?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
Perfect.
What don't you find on Amazon?
I know. I keep forgetting that, and I'll think, oh, I need to go to the store and get this, and then all of a sudden, okay, I don't need to go anywhere. I just have to go on Amazon.
Yeah.
Talk about how the idea for the book came to you, and just how you put all of this together, and explain what this is to the audience.
Well, there's two main themes to your question. First, how the book came to be was putting together the beginner's eye retreats that I do, that I take to retreat centers. And this is basically that retreat in a book form that guides people through how you can use photography as a contemplative tool. So as I continued to do retreats, I was hearing that people wanted to come but couldn't, and did I have it in a book or something like that? So I decided to do it that way. How I came to photography as a contemplative tool was really on two very separate paths. One was my interest in photography that started when I was a teenager, and the other was my path as a Zen Buddhist, and as they were parallel for quite a while, I began to notice that as my Buddhist practice developed, it began to cultivate what is commonly referred to as clear seeing, being able to see things more accurately and in their true nature. And I was noticing that whenever I had a camera in my hand, the same thing was beginning to happen. That I began to really see things very differently when I had a camera in my hand. And so as time went on, I began to see that obviously with my Zen practice, meditation is a big part of that. But I also saw that approaching things through the lens of a camera was also a meditation as well. So then I began to bring the two together and start offering retreats and having some fun with that.
Well, I'm sure your retreats are fabulous. When I think about looking through a camera lens, it really is focusing you on one area, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're not seeing all of this other stuff. So it is, you're able to eliminate distractions in a way.
Very much so. And it's one of the things that the book endeavors to do is to help people really begin to pay more and more attention to the more subtle patterns and shapes and textures and light and shadow that's around them all the time. And then to begin to cultivate a greater sense of connection to, you know, how that light is reflecting off the leaf, for example. And, you know, then to bring the camera into it as a way of capturing that. And, you know, there's two things I really stress with this. And one is, even though it says photography and all that stuff, it's really not about the camera at all. As a matter of fact, when I do the retreat, I have a slideshow that I put up there of pictures that were taken with cell phones. And you basically cannot tell that they were taken by cell phones.
Right.
And so it's, you know, so it's really not about the camera or photographic acumen or anything like that. And the other piece I really stress is that seeing is a complete sensory experience. It isn't just something you do with your eyes. You know, in my book, I talk about, you know, the definition of seeing also means to perceive with any of the senses, to experience or to be aware of, to observe. And so I really encourage people to see with all of their senses, to see with their ears, to see with their touch, to see with their smell. Seeing just means to be able to formulate a real meaningful connection to what you're in the presence of.
And I, you know, I was having this conversation with my children recently talking about the senses and which sense we, you know, each of us saying which sense we would miss the most. And I think, you know, for all of us, it was unanimous that it would be sight.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I could, you know, be deaf, and but I would, and that would be okay. Sometimes more than others, but to miss seeing, I mean, it would be a big loss.
Mm-hmm. And we place a lot of emphasis on our sight.
Yeah. And but sometimes we forget how lucky we are that we're looking at the stuff. And you mentioned that in the book, and that also gets highlighted in your mindfulness workbook. But really paying attention and seeing things, trying to find things that you don't notice in your day-to-day life, like on your drive where you're always in the, talk about that and just these little things that we can do that may or may not involve the camera as a tool to get us to this place.
Sure. And that is one of the things that the feedback I continually get is that after people have gone through this, they report that with or without a camera, that they're seeing things very differently. And then one individual said that I'm noticing things about my wife's face I'd never seen before.
Wow.
You know, and routine is one of the killers of our sensual awareness. It deadens our senses because we just anticipate that the same thing, it's going to be the same thing over and over and over again, when in fact, even though you're going down the same road, it is not the same road you went down that morning. There are very definite changes that have happened, and are you noticing those? You know, there was a situation a while ago in a neighboring town where a bridge was taken out for repair, and the people, in order to get into La Crosse, had to take almost a 15-mile detour. And they had to go up over the ridge and come down and what have you to get to work. And boy, the grousing and complaining and, oh my goodness, this is so inconvenient. That when the bridge finally got finished and people could take the 7-minute route or the 7 to 10 minute route to La Crosse, people were saying that they were missing the detour, because it woke them up to more areas of their surroundings that they hadn't paid attention to.
Right.
And so it is a matter of, you know, waking up and seeing things with all of our senses. And one of the things that, you know, can you see with your, can you see with your ears? And can you smell with your eyes? And begin to mix things up a little bit and see, you know, what happens when you break out of the routine and the dulling aspect of what we perceive to be sameness, when it really isn't, because even though it may look the same on the surface, there are many things that have changed just within the day.
Yeah. You know, I really love the idea about using the camera to get you to this place where even if you don't have the camera, you're still noticing things and thinking about them or framing them in terms of the, you know, the lens. I was out for a run this morning with my dog, Doug, and I had a beginner's eye moment, and I went to reach for my phone, but then I remembered that I'm choosing not to run with it because I don't want, I'm trying to just be in the moment of the run and not, you know, hearing my phone go off. But the clouds were so beautiful.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, oh, I want to take this photograph for Tom. And, but I tried to, you know, I stood there for a minute and really took it in. And that was after reading your book and really thinking about that. So I really like that connection a lot. And I think that we can all stand to stop and take a breath and take an extra minute to enjoy what's in front of us and look at it differently.
And
I felt like I had that moment this morning, which made me feel really good. It had a positive impact on the start of my day.
Nice.
Yeah.
And how often do we actually look up?
Yeah, right?
And, you know, we're either looking out ahead or down on the ground. How often do we look up and say, geez, what's above us? And sometimes, you know, as you said, it can be very surprising and very pleasant.
You know, you have some beautiful photographs in your book, and one of the things that made me think about you when I saw the sky this morning when I was running is the way that you talk about light hitting things a certain way and transforming them, and that's really what was happening with the sky. It was the clouds were kind of breaking apart, but you still couldn't see the sun, and the light that was coming through them was so beautiful and so magical. But you have examples of that in your book, and you talk about that, and it's really interesting to think about changing how light can change your perspective and the way things look and focus on that.
And you know, recall when we were children, how we used to lay out in the yard to look up at clouds and see things.
Yeah.
You know, we'd see dogs.
The Rorschach of clouds. Yeah.
Absolutely. And then we'd name them or, you know, just get lost in how they would change and what have you. And as we bring our attention away from that and begin to focus more on the images in our mind rather than what's actually occurring around us, we lose track of that. You know, we spend so much time inside of our heads, you know, creating thoughts and images and ideas that might have happened yesterday or 2 weeks ago or 2 years ago, that it really disconnects us from paying attention. I had one individual tell me that she was lamenting about the traffic jam that she was in every evening going home, until she stepped back and took a deep breath and started to look at the reflection of her car in the bumper in front of her and say, geez, I wish I had my camera so I could capture that.
Yeah.
And then she said, very much like you did, I don't need it. I'm just noticing something I wouldn't have noticed before. I'm seeing my headlights all kind of distorted and the color of my car kind of stretched out on the bumper of the car in front of me. And she said, I would have otherwise just been kind of grousing and complaining and honking my horn.
Yeah. Well, that's why I think this book is such a great idea in your workshops, to just add that tool that can make people, even if that's the trigger, oh, I wish I had my camera, then mm-hmm. okay, you know, to go that next step. We're going to take a short break.
Sure.
And we will be back to discuss The Beginner's Eye. My special guest is Thomas Roberts. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Relationships 2.0. I'm chatting with Thomas Roberts. By the way, his website address is thomasrobertsllc.com, about his new book called The Beginner's Eye. I'm going through your manuscript and all of the stuff that I highlighted, and you always have, as you did in the mindfulness workbook that you wrote, always these little pearls that I latch on to. And one of the things that you say in this book that I love so much is that your relationship to all things softened.
Mm-hmm.
Say more about that. I mean, and I thought a lot about that today, but
sure.
I think that's so, if we can all get to that place, right?
Well, based on breaking down kind of our sense of separateness, that if we stay really connected or attached or possessive of our ego, of our pride, of our personality, of our title, whatever it might be, it naturally separates us from other human beings and life in general. And because we maintain a kind of a position of I have to protect my sacred territory that I define as me. And if there's any mm-hmm. threat to that, I become defensive and angry and what have you.
Right.
When we allow ourselves to relate to what is around us, the world that we are intimately immersed in, whether we like it or not, we are able to relax a little bit more in terms of not seeing that everything outside of me, everything that is not me, is not a threat. It's not
right.
something that is going to hurt me or what have you. Criticism doesn't have to be taken personally. Those kinds of things. And so what it allows us to do is to relax and learn how to relate with greater compassion and patience with one another. That, mm-hmm. that all of life is a process. It's constantly trying to emerge to a different state. And moment by moment by moment, that is always going on. And if we're so busy trying to protect that sacred thing we call me, we can't relate to another person because we perceive them as a threat. And
right.
so by doing something, like just looking at our surroundings with a softer perception, it softens how we relate not only to ourselves, but also to others as well. And it underscores a lovely little Zen saying that I like to quote frequently is, you are none other than me with a different name and a different face.
Mm-hmm.
And can we bring ourselves to say that to that cloud that you saw this morning?
Right.
Because that's basically true. If you want to take it on a grand cosmic level, the iron that is inside of our bodies is exactly the same iron that is in the great huge galaxy furnaces around the universe. And so we're able to relate with greater empathy and compassion to one another because we feel that profound sense of connection. And that if I can see you as none other than me with a different name and a different face, I can also join you in your journey as well. and not have to see that your journey could be a threat to me.
Right. Yeah, that's so important.
Yeah.
So important.
Yeah, and if we can soften ourselves, and in the first place we have to soften how we relate to ourselves, obviously.
And, right.
And not to
the
be so judgmental.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Which is what you, everyone, by the way, should just have your mindfulness workbook, The Beginner's Guide to Overcoming Fear and Embracing Compassion. I feel like that should be required reading for everyone. And this book as well, because it's a different kind of, it's, the messages are so compatible, but it's a different way of looking at it. And that's why I think all of these messages are so important, because some things are going to resonate with someone more than others, you know. So I just think it's so beautiful the way that you present your expertise in The Beginner's Eye.
Well, it's a fun process, as well as is, you know, being able to broaden this whole perspective of meditation. Meditation just isn't sitting with your eyes closed.
Yeah.
It's also learning how to, as I just got done talking about, soften how you perceive the world around you with all of our senses, and feel the vibrancy and the energy that's going on all the time. And not close ourselves off to that.
Well, that brings me to one of the other things I highlighted in your book, and that is, when we learn something new, we are asked to face the limits of our growth, and resistance naturally arises. Just let your resistance become your awareness that you are almost at the point of expanding your journey. Embrace
right.
your resistance.
Mm-hmm.
Elaborate on that, because I think that's a really important lesson.
Well, it's one thing I refer to as insistence and resistance, that we insist that things go the way we think they should, and then when they don't, which oftentimes they don't, we resist, and we put a tremendous amount of energy into trying to bend, mold, and shape the natural flow and emergence of our experience into our preconceived ideas and expectations.
Yeah. I've definitely done that before, and I find over time that when I can let go and just let things happen the way they're not going to happen, and that doesn't mean some, you know, passive way of going about life, but it's
right.
just about not, it's about softening, right?
Mm-hmm.
That I am then always surprised, and almost always I say to myself, wow, why was I fighting against that so much?
Uh-huh.
Or why was I so resistant to that?
Exactly.
This is great. This turned out well. This was a fabulous experience.
And you know, to be able to soften like that and learn how can I relate to what's occurring in the most skillful fashion. And if I can change how I'm viewing what's going on around me in a more patient, compassionate kind of way, I don't have to spend so much time resisting. I can, you know, rather than trying to paddle my boat upstream all my life, I can turn the boat around and learn just how to guide it downstream, because it's where the river's going anyhow.
I love that.
And you know, I could say, yeah, but I, you know, I've always been told I have to paddle upstream, because that's what we as a family do, or we as a nation do, or we as a culture
right.
do.
Work hard, dig in, right?
Oh, yeah.
Everything has to be hard. Everything has to be an enormous challenge.
Yep. Yep. When all you have to do is turn the boat around, then you just guide it. And,
yeah.
Because, you know, the river's going to go where the river's going to go, and it really doesn't care what you think.
Right.
And yet you still have some control,
a sense of, you know, having some say in what's going on. It may mm-hmm. not, you know, it's not 100%. It may be, you know, at times it may be very small amount.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. And I think one of our challenges for ourselves as human beings, as spiritual beings, is to let go of our insistence to control outcome.
Yeah.
And if we can recognize that we cannot control outcome as much as we'd like to think we can influence moments and ask ourselves, how can I best influence navigating down this river? I can't tell the river where to go. I can't tell it to turn right or bend left or have a waterfall or smooth out. The river is going to have its own characteristics and flow. How best can I influence my journey on the river rather than trying to tell the river what to do?
And
I think as, you know, being able to look at things, and engage them with a greater sense of interaction rather than having to force yourself on your experiences or other people can be transformative and especially in like relationships, rather than trying to get somebody else to be the way you want them to be. How can I be in relationship with somebody in a way and offer what is the most useful right now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that can be very helpful when you have teenagers or a difficult boss or whatever it might be. You know, rather than insisting, you step back and say, let's work with this. And how can I, how can I guide myself through this?
The other thing that I've been, I totally agree with you, and it reminds me of something that I've been thinking a lot about lately, and that has been discussed before on this show, but that oftentimes we get so stuck on expectations we have of other people that we're mm-hmm. in a constant state of disappointment. Everyone's falling short. And then, you know, along with the self-critic, of course, we always think we're falling short as well. And so there's this chronic state of disappointment that everyone mm-hmm. is in, rather mm-hmm. than softening, as you say, and being open to receiving what each person has to offer. And because everyone has different capacities.
Yeah.
Everyone has different things that they bring to the table. You can't get, I don't think you can get everything from one person, and the expectation that you should be able to, or that if this friend of yours is truly your friend, they should be there for you when for everything is, of course, you're always going to be disappointed. It's
yeah.
simply not possible.
Exactly, because it's expecting perfection out of another person rather
right.
than embracing their humanness and the fact that there are going to be times when they're not going to be there for you.
And one of the things that I love about tying all of this in with the photography is, you know, nature is so beautiful, and what we look at every day
mm-hmm.
is so stunning. And
mm-hmm.
if we can draw on that for our views and expectations of human beings and accept those flaws as beautiful the way that we do in nature.
Exactly. Exactly. And one of the really powerful parts of not only the book but also the retreat is when I encourage people to go out and begin to find and look around for a struggle in nature that mirrors their own.
Oh, I love that.
And to, you know, and as I say throughout the book and also in the retreat, don't look for a photograph. Don't look for something. Let it find you. Because mm-hmm. it's out there waiting. And if you clear your senses and are open and receptive, it will all of a sudden emerge out of the background. About 10, 15 years ago, that little puzzle that was real popular where you stare at kind of a colored sheet of paper. If you stare long enough, an image begins to come out of the background.
Oh, right.
And I can't remember what those were called, but I know they were real popular. I could never get it, but I ask people to do that. You know, soften their senses that all of a sudden what's been waiting for you will begin to emerge out of the background. And so I have people go out and recognize that A, they're not alone. B, not only do other people struggle, but everything in nature is out there. And if you look for it, you can find something in nature that speaks to you in terms of its resilience, its beauty, its determination, that you can draw strength from.
Absolutely. We're going to take another short break, and when we come back, we're going to dig in some more. You're listening to Relationships 2.0. My special guest is Thomas Roberts. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Relationships 2.0. I'm chatting with Tom Roberts about his new book, The Beginner's Eye. It will be out in August. And you can find out more by going to his website, thomasrobertsllc.com. One of the things you have in this book that mm-hmm. was a little bit intimidating to me was the haiku.
Surprise, surprise.
Do you hear that from a lot of
people? Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I don't know why poetry's always been so. When I was young, I think when I was younger, before I developed all the, fears about stuff or feeling self-conscious or whatever, I used to write. I would sit and write poems, and I found some that are pretty funny. But then at some point, I think I must have realized that they were kind of silly and that I really wasn't very good at it. And so, except for a few poetry classes I think maybe I took one poetry class in college, and it was painful. really painful. But I have to say that I love the way that you present it in your book. And even though you say it's a little bit of cheating, I do love that little chart that you made.
Isn't that great?
I think that's fabulous. I was so excited to see that. I think that makes it really accessible for people.
Well, I have to tell you
this really funny thing. I think on this, there's this website called BuzzFeed and they're like on Twitter or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And, one day when my daughter and I were in the car, she said, "Oh, BuzzFeed has one of these quizzes where you have to guess if this haiku was written by a kid or it's actually a published haiku, like a famous haiku." And so she was reading them to me while I was driving, and I got most of them right, because these were, I think, like fourth graders or something who had written these other haikus. But what it made me think is what you say in your book about be playful with this,
mm-hmm.
and don't take it so seriously. And I think when we get into adulthood, we get so locked into being serious about it, and we need to dig back to the poet I was, find the poet I was in my childhood.
Sure. You know,
when I didn't care, when I thought it was good, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And
so talk about how this ties in with the photography and the mindfulness and all of that.
Sure. Well, I've always, as opposed to most people, when I was forced to, tackle poetry in high school I really just did not like poetry because there was so much how to do it right and how to do it wrong.
Right.
And when we had the section on haiku, I just remember saying, oh, this makes a lot of sense. You know, first of all, it's only three lines. Even though, we were graded on it and whether we got the 17 syllables and all that kind of stuff, at that time I found it to be very, very playful, and that always kind of stuck with me, and I've worked with haiku off and on. I developed a way to use haiku in my hypnotherapy as a way of creating a sense of curiosity and wonder. I will craft haiku during a session. So it's really kind of permeated in a lot of different areas. And this was something as I was looking at bringing these, the meditation and photography together. I was really looking at, well, okay, this is all great. You take a picture. Well, so what? And then I thought to myself, how could we introduce something that would allow the person who's working at developing a beginner's eye to say something about that picture that has meaning to them but would be very evocative to the reader? And I thought to myself, bing, haiku, because I didn't know of a better way and more concise way to do that. Plus, haiku is a very challenging and playful way to awaken your senses. In my book, I have an exercise where people do a haiku with their different senses, like sight, smell, and texture. One is tree, color, and water. For example, the old oak stands naked against the gray sky, a dewdrop form. So each line, the first one is a tree, the second one is a color, and the third line is water. So again, it fits in with the photography in terms of waking all of our senses up, softening how we relate to our surroundings, and notice what's there.
Yeah.
The haiku can be a very disciplined kind of thing, but for the purposes of this experience, I really do highlight the playfulness and the creativity of it.
Do you find that in your workshops that people kind of soften up fairly quickly when they start sharing their haiku, that initially maybe they're a little self-conscious and then they start having fun with it?
Mm-hmm. Yep, and I walk them through a couple of exercises to help them kind of get familiar with how to do this. And after they kind of get the hang of it and realize that it isn't, high school poetry or college poetry or wherever they may have been tortured with it. They really kind of begin to see how when they let the photograph emerge, they capture it with their camera, and then they stay in the presence of what they captured and allow the haiku to come. They really see how beautifully it comes together.
Right.
Like there's a favorite one of mine in the book, where there's a picture of a plank, I think, on a kind of a dilapidated porch, and these blades of grass are sticking up through the plank. And this is the haiku the person wrote: "Life does not know no."
Oh.
So it does not know.
Right.
And then
you
no.
Know.
So I mean, here are these blades of grass pushing up through this. This old piece of wood, and that just came to this person, and so they really are able to see how that when they soften their relationship between themselves and their surroundings, they really begin to find that sense of very deep and profound connection.
And that's I mean, I think even doing the haiku, you're kind of going through that process. You're opening yourself up more, making yourself more vulnerable, because it's probably really out of the ordinary for most of us.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you have show-offs who come to your workshop, though, who are really good at it. But
yeah, every once in a while.
You get
every once in a while.
Who's really rocking the haiku?
Yes. Yeah. But it's amazing to see how people come up with stuff that have never written haiku in their whole life. And as I said, it really helps kind of bring that whole kind of experience together of learning how to relate to yourself and softening that relationship.
Yeah, it's so fabulous. What else do you want the listeners to know about this book and why you feel so passionate about it and the message?
Well, first of all, this isn't the only book that's out there. There is a greater interest in contemplative photography. And which is really exciting. What I have endeavored to do is really try to take an area like photography, which oftentimes is very, very technical and intimidating for some people, and soften that a bit as a way of helping them learn how to relate. That this is not a technical book. This is a playful book for you, for the reader to work through and see how paying attention on a variety of different levels can really change how you do relate to yourself and how you do relate to others.
Yeah.
And to be able to find that sense of connection, that this isn't a technical book. It's as I said, people can use cell phones if they want. So it really is not about the camera or any kind of technical background, and also to expand this whole thing about, you know, what is relating mindfully or skillfully or in a meditative kind of way. What is that really all about? And as I said earlier, it's not just about sitting somewhere with your eyes closed. It's, you know, 90% of what I think living a mindful or meditative or contemplative life is all about is with your eyes open and all your senses
Wow.
open, and how you're engaging and interacting with the vibrant life around you in a skillful and compassionate and caring kind of way.
Wow, I love what you just said. And I think that it's such a great message, because we've talked about this before, but I think that mindfulness and meditation can be so intimidating to people, because they do think that it means you have to sit with your legs crossed in a really quiet room and your eyes are closed and, you're supposed to clear your head so you don't have any thoughts and,
Good luck with that.
Yeah, exactly. There are all of these misconceptions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, it's no accident that both of your books, you've used, beginners in both of them. And I think that one of your gifts is that you do such a great job of introducing people to the world of the beautiful world of mindfulness, and you have an extraordinary talent for it. And so anyone who is thinking about this should grab both of your books. One thing I was thinking about when I was reading your book is that I recently went through absolutely everything to organize and give away and all of that, and I found so many great cameras that I didn't want to part with, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some really You know, I have this really loving attachment to them. Mm-hmm. It was so nice to, I mean, I appreciate that you're telling people, look, all you need is your smartphone. Not everyone has a camera.
Right.
But what about having that additional, you know, sensory experience of getting out the old camera and, you know, and the way that, you know, just the way that you need to hold it. I got stopped when I was running the other day by these tourists who asked me to take a photograph, and they had a big camera. It was a camera. And it took me a second to, like, I was holding it away from me like you hold a phone, and then I thought, wait, no, what am I doing? I need to put my eye up to the little thing so I can see through it. And I actually like that better because it blocks everything else out. You're really only seeing, whereas with the phone, you can still, you know, your eye isn't up against it. You're holding, you tend to hold it away, or maybe that's just my eyesight is why I'm holding it arm's length away, but maybe other people hold it closer. But I think the cell phone's really handy for when, like, you're on the go and and you're, oh, here's something I want to take a photograph of. But I really got nostalgic for using the camera again, and then reading your book, I was feeling like, oh, this is a message, you know. Tom's sending me a message. I need to open, because I put all the cameras in one place. I need to pull out those old cameras. And
It is amazing. I still have my very first Kodak Instamatic camera.
Nice.
And whenever I have that in my hand, it takes me back to summer camp in Wyoming, almost as if I'm there, just holding it. And then I'll click it, and then I'll advance the film lever and what have you. And just the tactile touch of looking through the camera and thinking of all the pictures I took as a 10, 11, 12-year-old youngster. And personally, I prefer having much more of an intimate contact with my photographic tool than holding a, you know, a cell phone out or an iPad out or something like that. there is something about just holding it right up and just looking through it that connects you a little bit more. But it is amazing. I just look at that little camera and it transports me.
Yeah, I know, it's pretty fabulous. Well,
it is.
Your book transported me. Thank you so much, Thomas Roberts, author of The Beginner's Eye. Tom, it's always a treat. And thank you so much for being so supportive of me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, Michelle. You're doing great work. You're doing great work.
Thanks so much. So
you
are
bet.
You.
All
we'll
right.
Talk again soon. Take
okay.
care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to Relationships 2.0. I'll be back next week. Thanks for joining me.